I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
We were at a soccer conference near Miami, and I woke up one morning with the phone ringing. My investors were calling me to tell me to turn on the TV because Wayne Rooney, at the time, was the captain of Manchester United and the peak of his career, was wearing one of our products on national television and had made a spectacular comeback when people thought that he was going to be out for several weeks.
Hey, Sebastian Alvarado. Welcome back to Coffee and Football, where I sit with some of the most interesting and influential profiles in the game to learn about their life and career journeys. This podcast is presented by 11 New York, a football brand and concept that creates refined athletic wear and original content for those of you with an eye for taste and quality. Check it out at 11newyork.com. And full disclosure, I am a partner in the company, so maybe even further reason to check it out. It's 11newyork.com. In today's episode, my guest is Claudio Storelli. He's the founder and chairman of Storelli Sports, a company founded almost 10 years ago in Brooklyn, New York. They make some of the most innovative protective gear in soccer, and it's worn by the likes of Iker Casillas, Jesse Lingard, and Azpilicueta to kids all over the country. Born and raised in Milan, at 15, he came over to the U.S. as an exchange student, and follow me on this one. By the age he was 20, he had graduated from Stanford University with honors. By 23, he had done the same from Columbia Law School. After that, he joins McKinsey & Company as a management consultant, and in 2010, he moved to Bloomberg, where he became the chief operating officer of a $1 billion enterprise technology division. To say that Claudio is an overachiever is a bit of an understatement. This is a fascinating conversation. So, without further ado, here is my conversation with Claudio Storelli. Claudio Storelli, welcome to Coffee and Football.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
How you doing, man?
I'm doing good. Thank you. Feeling good.
You told me you took a little walk down here. We're in the studio downtown in the South Street Seaport, as usual. You're based here in the city.
Right. I'm in East Village.
Yeah, real hipster neighborhood.
That's right. Yes.
Well, my first question always obviously has to be, since the theme is coffee and football, how do you drink your coffee?
I drink coffee with a little bit of milk, and despite being Italian, I am not a coffee snob whatsoever. I like pretty much all kinds of coffees.
Where do you get it from?
Usually I make it at home, and we make it in the office. I am very easygoing when it comes to things like that.
Man, I hope the Italian community doesn't hear you, because they take great pride in their coffee. So Claudio Storelli, founder and CEO of your own company, named thereafter. How do you typically introduce yourself to someone who has no idea about who you are?
It kind of depends on the setting, but because the company is called with my last name, which, by the way, it happened because of admittedly lack of creativity at the time we created the company. My co-founder and I were kept coming up with very cheesy names for the company, and Under Armour was already taken. So at some point, neither of us were creative. And so it's like, look, Storelli, Italian, football, it talks about fashion, family. Let's just go with that, and then we can change it later. And initially it was a bit weird, and then now for me it's become normal. But because the company carries my name, especially if I meet people that are exposed to the brand a lot of times, I actually oftentimes find myself not introducing myself as Claudio Storelli, because there's a strange reaction in the way when people hear and they think about it. sometimes I let them think that it may be a family business and I didn't actually start it. But normally if I meet someone on the plane and they ask me what I do, I usually tell them that I run a sports technology company that focuses on keeping soccer players fit.
In retrospect, was it the right decision to name it Storelli?
Well, it's a good question. I think it doesn't hurt, and I think that we're making it work. So I don't regret the choice. And I have a philosophy of life, which is about learning from past mistakes, but not really dwelling too much on what could have been different. So I look at that, and I think that for the time, it was the right decision. Maybe you could have had a catchier name, but now that it's you, when you name something, a lot of times the name carries some meaning, but you really put meaning through your actions, you give meaning to that thing. And so I think that now when people know the brand, they hear the name, it works.
Yeah, you guys have done obviously a tremendous job so far. In talking about your job and your life, take me through a typical day. So from the moment you wake up, what kinds of routines do you have? And then from there on.
So I usually wake up to the sound of my son crying out that it's time to get up. It's usually around 6:30, 7 in the morning. I have a one-year-old. And I spend the first hour of the day with my son. I'm very committed as a parent, and my decision also to run my own company stems from the desire to make sure that I can do what's important to me in life. An hour later, I take a taxi to work. It's a beautiful car ride on the East Side Highway. You see the bridges, and then you get into Brooklyn. Our R&D lab and main office is in Dumbo, so right next to the Manhattan Bridge, next to the Brooklyn Bridge, in an area that now has become very hip. It was not very hip when we started, when got the office there the first time. And usually I'm the first person in the office, and I like that. I walk into my kingdom. It's quiet. I start turning on all the devices. We have a large TV that plays soccer all day long. I basically watch pretty much every game in every league out there. It's always playing in the background. And we have a lot of screens that display activity on our website and statistics. I like that technology aspect and the transparency that it brings to people that are within the company. Then I pour myself a cup of coffee with a little milk, sit at my desk. I have a desk with three screens, which is something that I got used to when I worked in finance. And then I start my day, and then people start trickling into the office, and the office really comes to life.
Do you have any specific readings that you do or sites that you go to every day to kind of stay up to date?
Yeah, so I get the Wall Street Journal every morning delivered to me. I peruse the Wall Street Journal basically on the way to the taxi, unless then there's something that really catches my attention. Obviously, I pay a lot of attention to news in the sports world, and I mean sports business, but I also pay a lot of attention to macroeconomic and international politics and business, because relationships with China, as an example, Europe, Russia, and even interest rates and currencies have a big impact on international business. And then I try to take time on both my car ride to the office and then to my car ride back to push my learning. So I usually pick an audiobook that will be instructional in some way. For example, right now I'm listening to a book by a Navy SEAL who talks about parenting. And there's a lot of lessons you also learn about business and what Navy SEALs go through to condition teamwork and push people to the boundaries and really get people to work as efficiently and as effectively as possible. It's something that to me is very valuable. So the car ride back and to the office and back from the office is the time where I try to learn something new. I think I'm gonna move on to learning Spanish next, but that's the time I study, let's say.
On that note, what are other things that you do to constantly keep evolving yourself as a business leader?
I think a lot of it is about pushing yourself out of the comfort zone. I try to think in a very structured way about what are the strengths that I have and then what are things that I don't do well. And then I try to pick topics or even activities during my workday that push that. I'll give you an example. When I started the company back in 2010 now, the direct-to-consumer online business was really just starting to become something. So you would look at the business when you started it and thought, I'm going to make 5, 10% of my sales through our website, and then most of it will come through stores. So the things you had to know at the time was mostly about how to sell to businesses and how to get those the business to succeed within a physical retail context. Now it's a lot more about how you tell stories and how you instruct people and educate people that are exploring your goods digitally, and how do you create a very well-oiled machine in the digital business world. So I've had to really force myself, instead of hiring people to do things for me, to learn all those tools and figure out how I can become a smarter business person. For me, it's about identifying areas of growth that I know I should be exploring, and not being lazy. And I think that's one of the key things that I found also in sports. It's nothing comes easy, and so unless I go through some pain and friction, I'm not going to get better. My team is not going to get better. And I try to instill that idea also in my team.
We already mentioned it here, and people may hear that you do have a slight accent. Tell me about that journey that took you from Italy to the US.
My dad was really big on us learning English. So starting at the age of 9, they started sending me for 3 weeks to basically the equivalent of camps for foreign students to England. My parents made me do that from the age of 9 up to the age of about 14, 15, and it allowed me to become comfortable with English. And then at the age of 15, my parents said, we believe that you being perfectly fluent in English and also being international will be an asset in the future. So they gave me and my brother the opportunity to study abroad, and they picked America. And so at the age of 15, I was accepted by an exchange family in Dayton, Ohio, for what was supposed to be a 10-month stint to learn English in American high school. And there's a couple of reflective points that come out of that. First of all, I remember getting on the plane to come to the U.S., and my father, who's a very philosophical man and a very, very learned man, said a sentence to me in Latin that has become one of the things I live by, which is quisque artifex fortune sue est, which means everyone is the maker of his own destiny. And he sent me off on the plane with my mom crying in the background, telling me basically, this is for you to make something out of it. When I arrived, I had the big luck of being accepted by a family who's now truly a second family to me. And because of their support and because of my drive to make something out of it, through soccer, I was able to get noticed by colleges around the U.S. And through my determination, just being a good student, I was able to get recruited and have an offer to and be accepted to go to college at the age of 16.
What school was that?
I started as a freshman in 1999 at Santa Clara University, which at the time was really a top national program. And that year, we made the national championship and lost against Indiana University. I was on the bench, admittedly. We played in the North Carolina Panthers Stadium live on TV, and it was just a defining moment for my life. And then after 2 years at Santa Clara, I realized that academically, I wanted something bigger in some sense, because I was so young, and because my grades were so good, and because I was international and I played in a national championship, from a checkmark perspective, I looked really good from academically. So I applied to Stanford. At the time, I had a girlfriend in San Francisco, so I said, being local will be good. They took me, and that's where I finished my undergraduate in 2003. But I couldn't get a job in the U.S. because I had no work visa. So graduate school was really the only path. So I thought, I studied economics, philosophy, maybe law is a good field. So I applied to law schools, got into Columbia Law School, and decided to go to law school. So at 20 years old, I find myself at Columbia Law School. Did that for 3 years. And after that, I still had no work experience. I was still really young. I was 23, but I had a graduate degree, and my resume looked really good. So I realized at the time that I didn't want to be a lawyer, and so I applied to a stretch position for me at a management consulting firm in New York, and I somehow they decided I was a good candidate despite complete lack of experience, and so I started a McKinsey & Company here in New York at the age of 23 with a position as a postgraduate role, even though I had basically not really done anything in my life other than studied and had a few summer jobs. And I remember starting there and being in the training class, and they put us into a group of just four people. And I look around this small room and we start introducing each other. One of the guys in the group was one of the founders of Facebook, Eduardo Saverin, who, if you watch the movie, ends up taking an internship in New York. That's where I met him. And another person who was an Australian doctor, was a Rhodes Scholar, an incredible person who is now the global head of strategy of the largest asset manager in the world, and still a close friend of mine. So I was really out of my league. I mean, I had done nothing. But then worked in New York in the finance world through McKinsey for 5 years and learned a lot. It was like business boot camp. Got my butt kicked many ways because I was really out of my league. But survived for 5 years. And then at that time, it's when it was around 2009, 2010, when I decided that I wanted to take matters really in my own hands and start a company and do it on my own. So that's when I started Storelli, but I had no money. So I needed to do it with a job, a day job. So I applied for a position at Bloomberg, which is a large financial services technology company in New York. And so for several years, I ended up nurturing this startup company at night, really, and on weekends. So I was in a suit during the day and then, talking to Chinese factories or, looking at designs for protective wear in soccer at night. And that's really the path that took me from being a 9-year-old learning English to then a 15-year-old studying in the U.S. and then eventually starting a company.
Wow. I mean, that's quite a path to be that young. Clearly, you were extremely talented as a student primarily. Where did that come from? Because it sounds like it was a fairly easy ride when you talk about it. Obviously, getting to Stanford at such a young age, getting to law school at Columbia. And to put it into some perspective, these are the top programs in the country. Where did that study head come from?
It really came from my family. And I realized at some point in college, as I was basically reporting back to my parents and calling really long distance, and Skype wasn't even in existence at the time. And a lot of it, for me, subconsciously, came from wanting to make my parents proud. They had given me this opportunity, and I felt like failure was not an option. And so every time I went into a class, my goal was always to just get an A. I basically strived for academic perfection, and I just studied, I don't want to say compulsively, but I took no chances. I was just a very good student. And the type of dedication is something that ended up sticking with me. Also in soccer, even though talent plays a big role in it. And I just, I wasn't Buffon and I didn't have a lot of those gifts. So my career didn't go quite as well. But it was really a sense of determination and knowing that what I didn't have in talent or just raw intelligence, I could make up, at least try to make up with hard work.
Hey, just a quick update. Coffin Football is now presented by 11 New York, a football brand of high-quality apparel that includes cotton tees, French terry bottoms, and my favorite, socks made out of merino wool. All products are made in Los Angeles and in North Carolina. Please visit 11newyork.com to view it all. And it's a special for Coffee and Football listeners. For a 15% off your next purchase, use discount code CF11. That is CF and the number 11. Thanks, guys. So in talking about Storelli, tell me about the moment when it hits you that this is a decent idea and I'm going to go for it.
I was playing indoor soccer at Chelsea Piers here in New York. And there's a lot of corporate teams. And it was a game actually between the McKinsey office from the New York office against the New Jersey office. And we took it pretty seriously. There was a lot of physicality, and it's, you know, there's this plexiglass around it, so there's a lot of bumping around. At the end of the game, we all walked out of the pitch, and we were all limping, or we were all like looking at like scratches and bruises. And I looked at that and I thought, the game itself is the beautiful game, and I find so much joy in it. But all I need is one little injury, and not because of the pain itself, or because it's an injury that will, you know, see you out for a really long time. But the destruction of the pain itself, or the injury, or the fear of the injury, detracts so much from the game, to the point where going into the game, or maybe the next game, it's in the back of your mind and you want to avoid it. And so you don't go in as hard. You don't play as carelessly, it's the wrong word. You don't play your heart out. And I always approach soccer with the idea that I played soccer because I loved it. I was obsessed with soccer. I am as a fan. I am as a soccer player. I just find joy in it. And the idea that something could ruin that experience bugged me. And when I looked at what equipment providers were providing, they were providing fantastic shoes and fantastic goalkeeper gloves or other gear. And yet these fancy Wall Street people were coming out all bruised. And so I thought, nobody's doing it. There is a need, and I find it to be very important, more important than whether the shoes that I'm wearing are the best, fastest shoes in the world. And then very, very naively, I thought, how hard can it be for me to create a solution? And so, again, naively, partnered with a fellow soccer player who was also entrepreneurially minded, and we organized a lunch to talk about what we've left to do to create a company that solved that problem.
And then what happened?
So after that, one lunch led to a number of to-do lists for each one of us. And again, we were the kind of people that would just not let things go. And so we just kept driving it, and we just kept running into issues and trying to solve them. And one of the first issues was to figure out how would two non-designers design clothing. We knew the need because we played, so we knew what we needed to protect. But we didn't have the technology, we didn't have the design capabilities, we didn't have the manufacturing capabilities. And so we split tasks. My partner was a PhD in biophysics and very well tuned with also the foreign manufacturing, because he's half Chinese, half American, and he started tackling arguably some of the harder logistical questions, and then we started looking at technology partners that could help us solve the problem. And then we, through sheer chance, we found an amazing designer, and the person is our head of product and head of technology today, and still, you know, one of my closest friends and teammates. And it all happened in many ways by chance.
What was the first product that you developed?
The first product that we developed was a pair of goalkeeper sliding shorts, because goalkeepers obviously get a lot of abuse. All you need is in preseason is to slide on a bad surface to just get a nasty bruise on your leg that will heal over the course of weeks if you don't touch it. But if you have another practice the next day, the first dive, you're going to feel so much pain, and it's going to reopen the wound. And it's hugely distracting, to the point where if you play, sometimes the goalkeepers will say, I can't dive because I'm injured. And I hated that, because there's nothing better, for at least for a goalkeeper, than to dive at every opportunity you have and really play with the joy. And so we focused on the product, and we decided to design something that would be really light and ergonomic, but at the same time, extremely protective.
How did you finance it? Because it sounds like a lot of product development, I mean, a lot of costs associated with that.
Yeah, we initially everything came out of our pockets. So we were very reckless. I had no concept of savings or the need to save for future needs. So my partner and I just invested probably way too much money into the business with a certain reckless confidence that we will be able to make it up in the future if really came to that.
And then from there on, how did you go about to start selling this? You mentioned that there weren't any products like that around. So you're essentially creating a new category, which means that you need to tell people about it and educate and create the need.
One of the first calls that I ever made to an external vendor was to soccer.com. And the reason for that is we had learned that they were the primary retailer in the U.S., but also learned that the company had started from two brothers who had started the business from scratch back in the 90s, and they had a reputation for being nice people. So I called up customer support, get on the phone with some nice lady from North Carolina, and she's expecting me to ask about, I don't know, Nike shoes and the size or something like that. And instead I asked about their CEO and whether he was a nice guy and whether how I could get in touch with him. She was very nice, and she told me, oh, here's the office of the phone number of the office of the president. Picked up the phone. I left a voicemail, and I basically said, hi, I'm Claudio Storelli. I'm a nobody. I have this idea. I really admire what you've done. I'd love to talk to you and just get your advice if you can spare a few minutes. And sure enough, and a sign that if you reach out to people and you mean well and you find the right person on the other end, like, good things can come. I got a call back, and I had a very good chat. We were invited to North Carolina to present our thoughts. And I give a lot of credit to that decision, because you can imagine what the life of a CEO of a large company is like, and some random kid calls you with a silly idea that will stands to make you very little money at best in the big scheme of what soccer.com is. But it gives you a sense of the character and the quality of people behind that business. And those meetings in North Carolina gave us a lot of confidence and showed us that there were other like-minded people in the industry. And so soccer.com ended up being one of our first customers, and at the time was July 2011. That's when we started selling our first units.
What did he tell you when you first pitched the idea?
So Mike Moylan is a very, very happy, very outgoing guy. And he was just very, very energetic. And didn't discourage me. And it's funny, because had I been in his shoes, I probably would have said, listen, very difficult industry. You're trying to create a niche. You know, good luck to you, but maybe you should stick to finance or do something else. But instead he said, look, interesting idea. Come talk to us, see if there's something there. So he was encouraging, and he opened the door a little bit. He didn't say we're going to buy a lot of it or you're going to become a billionaire with it. But it was enough to give us hope. And that's how it started.
So you go down there, you pitch in the idea. Then how does it actually happen? Like, how do you go about setting the price, for instance? And how do you know that's the right level that you're setting yourself at?
From a pricing perspective, there's two drivers of price setting. One of them is the cost of the goods. Obviously, that sets the low bar. Then on the high end, you see what's comparable out there and what customers are realistically willing to pay for something. And then there's your own conscience and your own desire to do something that people will really embrace. So we always took the philosophy of packing the goods with as much good stuff as it made sense to. So as we always thought, and we looked at Apple a lot and as an example, and we said, if the product is well designed and we can add features that are truly value added, let's do it, even if our margins will suffer. And then let's set a price that is justified by the value that we're bringing, but not so high that it will become unreasonably expensive. So an example is, we make a beautiful padded undershirt for goalkeepers, which costs us way too much to make. It's currently priced at $90. You can buy Under Armour just shirts for probably $120, $130 that have no padding, they have no technology, they just keep you warm. We do that and much more, but we price it at $90 because we know that the player is going to be a 15-year-old, a 17-year-old, a 13-year-old that can't afford to spend a lot of time, $150 for something like that. So we decided to take a hit so that we could be able to get in front of people and get the products adopted. And we actually then never really hiked the price, as we probably could do right now, because in many cases, I believe that as a brand, we will do better if we keep things in front of people and we get a lot of appreciation for the brand and the products, as opposed to trying to maximize short-term profit.
So once you started selling at soccer.com, what was that initial period? Like, were the products flying off the shelves or?
No, I remember a really funny meeting with one of their heads of marketing where my partner and I were there and we're talking and discussing all these incredible products they were trying to bring to market. And actually our head of design was there too. And then we said, so, you know, tell us, like, how much do you think we're going to sell of this? And he looks at us and said, are you putting a lot of marketing money behind it? And we're like, probably not to start. So he thinks about it and said, you'll sell one or two units. So my partner and I look at each other and just like wide in the face, we're like, one or two units? Just to put into context, when you make products of this kind, even the most forgiving factories will, at the very least, produce 500 units. So that means spending, you know, 250 years to sell through a production run. So that's when it dawned on us that we couldn't just build great products, and that in this world in general, marketing is just so important. And so that's when we decided that it was essential for us to really build a brand that spoke to people and that explained what we did in an inspiring way, as opposed to just making a great tool that nobody really knows about and that nobody associated with emotions.
And how did you go about that marketing?
Initially, it was all about deciding what the brand will stand for. And I found the part easy from one perspective and difficult from another. Easy because we had a very clear philosophy behind it. Our brand is not the brand that stands for winning at all cost, or we don't tell you that our products will make you win. That's not why we created them. We created them so that whether you are Iker Casillas, have won everything in your life and you're just want to keep playing, or you are a 9-year-old just starting up, we want to make our products something that allows you to leave all distractions in the locker room, and when you step on the pitch, all you focus on is the game and you get lost in it. So we always had a very clear idea that our products deliver, yes, physical benefits. That's the main benefit when you look at it superficially. But the major benefit is the psychology. And really what I see as the ultimate benefit is your ability to get lost in the moment. So with that concept of letting time really fly by when you're playing with our gear because you're so in it, we had to start telling a story that players and also a lot of the parents would recognize. And we learned quickly that you cannot sell protection as a defensive mechanism, because a lot of players don't really recognize that necessarily as a need or something they seek. If you're just starting to ride a bike and your parents force a helmet on your head, you feel dorky. You feel like they think you have your training wheels on, and it's not a sign of strength. We needed to convince people, really communicate to people, that this is not because you're afraid. This equipment is because you want to kick butt. This is because you're serious about your trade and you want to leave nothing to chance and you just want to love every second of it. And that's where then a lot of the communications around it and how we talk about the gear started evolving.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
How long did it take, by the way, from when you had that initial idea, you sat down with your partner for lunch, and you guys decided to start this company, to essentially when you sell your first product?
We started, the first conversation happened in fall 2009. We didn't actually create Storelli Sports at the time, LLC, until April 10th, 2010. And we didn't sell our first products until July 2011. So you basically almost had, you know, almost 2 years from conception to first product in market.
In those first few years, was there ever a moment when you really doubted?
I mean, yes. Many, many, many moments. The path has been far from easy. There's just so many hurdles that come your way. And to take a step back, we had no experience. We had never manufactured anything. It's one thing to say, you know, put something, sketch something and put a logo and design a product that's on paper, that's easily done. But then translating that into physical patterns, a product that can be easily put together with the right technology, and then looking after all of the logistics that go into sourcing all those materials, getting them into the right place, the quality control in the manufacturing, and then all the logistics to shipping it back and then distributing, where there's a lot of capital that goes into it. It takes a lot of money. It takes a lot of time. And I can't tell you how many times I'd be in Italy for Christmas with my parents on December 30th at 2 in the morning when everybody was sleeping, and I'd be on the phone with my partner in the US trying to figure out why something was delayed or why something was produced with a mistake in it. I think we face bankruptcy pretty much every 12 months, and there were many, many moments of self-doubt, but at the same time, there was always something in the back of our minds that maybe brought me back to me at school that said, you know, failure is just not an option. Keep pushing. You got to figure out a way to make this work.
What did those moments do to the kind of interpersonal relationships within the team?
They can be really stressful for a team. And that's why I think that it's extremely important for a company. It's really also applies to your family or to any personal relationship. To have a philosophy that embraces challenge, we mentioned it earlier. The struggle, the friction that comes with building, with growing, needs to be accepted. There's a line or a quote from a book I was just reading by a Navy SEAL that says...
You're a lot into the Navy SEALs here, huh?
That's right, yes. I admire their training and the philosophy behind it. That says, the easy day was yesterday. Just know that tomorrow will bring challenges, but don't look at those challenges with fear. Embrace those challenges because they will make you stronger. And it sounds cheesy, but it's also what makes life fun. If I give this example to my wife all the time, we'll go and she'll start, you know, have to listen to me talking about challenges in business, etc. And sometimes I take a step back and tell her, look, if someone tomorrow gave me a winning lottery ticket for $2 billion and told me, Claudio, you're now financially set, I wouldn't stop. Because where's the fun in that? I personally don't care about fancy cars. I don't care about anything really. So long as I can put food on the table for the family, what really drives me is the challenge, is the idea of building. It's the idea of getting people together, united towards a common goal so that you can build something. And so I'm lucky that the core people that stayed with us from the beginning, so this example, Tom Marchese, who's the most talented person I know and an absolute pillar of our company, who's been with us since 2010, the philosophy that we shared has always been to embrace these moments of difficulties. And the people that have worked for a company and then fallen off along the way are really the ones that got to a certain point where when they looked ahead, they thought, there's not enough here for me, or I'd rather take a path that is a little bit less stressful. And I think that especially now when I look around the office all the people that work for our company, I think we have a makeup of people who share the same philosophy, and we have a list of 10 work principles we live by. A lot of it has to do with getting out of your comfort zone and knowing that friction needs to be embraced.
So when you felt like or you saw that now we're actually starting to reach a bit wider, we're a real company. It's gone from an idea to a cool product to getting into some retailers. But what was the tipping point?
I think that one of the defining moments happened in 2013, so a couple of years in, when we were at a soccer conference near Miami. And I woke up one morning with the phone ringing. My investors were calling me to tell me to turn on the TV because Wayne Rooney, at the time, was captain of Manchester United and the peak of his career, was wearing one of our products, the head protection, the head guard, on national television, and had made a spectacular comeback when people thought that he was going to be out for several weeks. And he proceeded to have one of the most productive stints of his career, where he got England qualified for the World Cup, he had some amazing goals, and was always wearing this iconic headband that made a lot of people think, what is he wearing on his head? And our logo, even though the team had often colored it so that you wouldn't really see it, was rather visible. And he put us in the map, and he gave us a sense of saying, wow, what started as two guys in the equivalent of a New York garage is now in front of billions of people watching TV and being used by one of the top players in the world, and gave us a lot of street cred. That was really one of the key moments where it kind of dawned on us.
How did that happen?
So that's another story of hustle. I was reading the Italian Gazzetta dello Sport online, and I saw a picture of Wayne Rooney with a huge gash on his head, and the news that he was probably going to be out for several weeks because he couldn't head the ball. And we were at the time developing our head guard, and it was very much in the preliminary stages. When I say preliminary stages, we couldn't get sizing right because it's actually, the sizing is highly unconventional, and you're trying to create something that will really hug your head, but without having Velcro or some annoying devices, and will have to be really, really protective. We knew we had something that could really help. So I called up some friends at World Soccer Shop, who we were close with, was part of the soccer.com family. And I said, do you know how email addresses work at Manchester United? Because they deal with a lot of the replica shirts. And they said, yes, it's first name, the last name at manunited.com. So we looked up the team doctor, and I sent a Hail Mary email to them saying, Wayne Rooney head injury solution, and we said, we have the solution. I got a quick response back saying, sure, FedEx over some samples, and I sent them out. That was on a Thursday. I then take off on Friday, go to Miami, and Saturday morning, Wayne Rooney is wearing the head guard on TV. And that's how it started.
Did sales after that peak? Or
no. So you would expect something like that to give you all of a sudden to make the business. But it's not one of those stories where a brand goes on, I don't know, Vogue and suddenly becomes the next new thing. Because what we sold, what we created, was something that had a very specific purpose. Only people that perceived that as a need started gravitating towards the brand. So it gave us a certain level of notoriety and let's call it street cred. But it didn't necessarily make the business commercially. It just meant that we were now a name that people in some cases knew, or we could say, hey, we're the same brand that makes that.
10 minutes to play. Rooney it is. And Rooney scores his first goal of the season.
We've talked a little bit about the headgear, about some of the goalkeeper sliders. What does the product range look like?
We aim to have a solution for any relevant injury in soccer, from head to toe, with the exception of shin pads. And the reason for not doing shin pads is because I truly believe that we should do things when we can do exceptional things and really add value. And I just don't see a need for more shin pads. There's already millions of them, and I still use the ones that I use as a sophomore in college, and they work just fine, so I don't see that as a need. But from for the lower leg, for example, we decided that one of the problems that people face is that shin pads often move around and they can be really annoying. But more importantly, when you get tackled and when you tackle, the impact is often everywhere else in the leg or the ankles but the shin pad itself, which saves you every once in a while. But it's almost rare to just get hit on the shin pad really hard. Otherwise, you wouldn't see so many players rolling on the ground. So we created one of our first products was what we call a leg guard, which is a sleeve that holds your shin pad, and you can put whatever shin pad you want in. It's designed to fit any types of shin pads, but then adds this very specialized type of soft but highly resistant padding on the side of the leg and on the ankles, so that when you get tackled, you can basically run through tackles unless you obviously lose your balance. And from there, then we protect. We have many different types of sliders that are designed to protect from very light ones just from turf burns to then impact and different levels of impact, different types of pants, upper body protection mostly for goalkeepers, and then head. And then in addition, we have a line of protective goalkeeper gloves, and we have some footwear, primarily in socks and insoles, that are designed to help tractions of your feet, reducing blisters, but also giving you the ability not to lose valuable reaction time when you're diving as a keeper or when you're sprinting as a field player.
What's the best-selling product?
Right now, they are the leg guards, the gloves, and the headgear. If you think about it, it makes sense because from the goalkeeper perspective, gloves are an item where you need several pairs a year. So once people try our gloves, and they're really second to none in quality because we actually share our factory with a couple of the biggest brands. And then when you look at it from a field player perspective, everybody wears shin guards, so leg guards are just a no-brainer. They work really well from professional players to little kids, so we move a lot of units of those. And then headgear, because we're really the premier company, if really I consider ourselves the only real company in that space. And so when players are worried about concussions or they're worried about head injury or returning from a head injury, we're the go-to.
When it comes to head injuries or concussions, I mean, it's a big topic even beyond soccer. How do you need to approach that product? I can imagine that there's, you know, you can run into, you know, liability or claims. And
so in two ways. First of all, that's the kind of product where you cannot take shortcuts. We made a conscious decision at the very beginning of our effort in the headgear space to design a headband-style product. We have been asked to create all kinds of different versions. We only make one product, and we make the best product we can make of that type. It doesn't come in all different colors. It doesn't come in all different shapes and forms. We make one product, and we make sure that that one is the best possible. And to give you an example, one of the ways in which we make it the best possible product is we have an exclusive partnership with a manufacturer of U.S. Army and Special Forces helmets. We take the lining that they use for the helmets of Navy SEALs and, you know, Special Ops Forces. We change the padding so that it doesn't remove spring from the ball so that you can head the ball without affecting the way that you head it. And then put it in the form of something that fits really comfortably on the head. But when it comes to then impact absorption, it is now proven through studies. So Virginia Tech does a rating of headgear similar to the one they do in football and hockey. And we are the uncontested number one. And it is because of the design of the product and the materials that we put in it, which are all made in the U.S. And so really make the cost of the product much higher. But it means that if you want to decrease the risks of injuries, there's nothing better. That's number one. And the second thing is about communications. And it's always been our philosophy to be really blunt about what we do and what we don't do. So our headgear, for example, and I think things are about to change, there's no study that has ever been conducted at scale that can demonstrate the impact on concussions. So we don't say this is it's not an anti-concussion band. What it is it's a headband that absorbs impact so that if you get hit with a head-to-head collision or by the ball, it will do the most anything can possibly do and still be usable in soccer to cushion that blow. And we have the lab studies to show that it's very effective at that. What happens within in the brain is a different matter. And so far, we haven't made any claims to that, even though Virginia Tech actually forecasts the reduction in concussion risks and assigned to our product 84% reduction value, which is, if you think about it, means really, really high. There's almost 80%, 9 out of 10 concussions can basically be removed according to their model. But we don't lean on that because we believe that what's really needed is a large field study. You need to have thousands of kids with the headgear, thousands of kids without, as a control group. And then over the course of years and seasons, you need to measure concussions with the right staff to assess them, to then look at whether statistically you're really having an impact. Because lab tests are very controlled and it's really hard to simulate what really happens on the field. So far, the data has been missing. But luckily, a study was commissioned 2 years ago by NOCSA, which is the North American body that regulates protective wear in sports. And the results are coming out in a matter of potentially months, if not weeks. So there will be something, a big piece of research that will come out in the near future that will be the most conclusive data on whether our headgear actually helps concussions. And we're very bullish that it will show some very strong positive results.
We talked about some of the early marketing efforts that you did in creating the brand. Where you are today, what does your approach look like?
Right now, we're focusing on... We have two major line of communications. One of them is focusing on goalkeepers as a class, because goalkeepers are really... They are in a class of their own. It's the personality of a person that becomes a goalkeeper tends to be different. You need to...
And to make it very clear, you are a goalkeeper.
I am a goalkeeper, yes. So I know what it's like. So we like to think of ourselves as basically the Ferrari of goalkeeper gear. What we make is second to none, because a lot of the bigger brands focus primarily on gloves but don't really look at the body as much. So in social media and our communications, we say our gear is built like no other, and it is, if you don't want to take any chances, this is where you go. And it's why we get a lot of incoming requests from professional players. When people look at our website, they see a lot of bigger names. There's a lot more that wear the gear. We just don't have the rights to show their imagery. We pay none of them. Literally, we don't pay any professional athlete to wear our gear. We never have. And the reason for that is because what we do is not a logo on a shoe, and there's a million types of shoes. And so as a player, you can say, hey, who's going to pay me more? I'm going to wear this or this other brand. We do something that will enrich your experience on the field, will enrich your performance, and also will lengthen your career, which is why if you look at Instagram and you look at what Iker Casillas is wearing at practice, you will see the Strelli logo, and you will see goalkeepers from West Ham to Real Betis wearing our gear. They do it because they love it and they love what it does to them. And so we like to talk to goalkeepers as a class because we respect it, we really value it, and that's one. Then there's the field players. And the field players is a different beast because it's also a much more crowded space and it's dominated by some really large brands. And so there, the messaging is not completely different, but we focus on different elements that are more performance-oriented, because that's what a lot of field players are primarily drawn to. And so we try to show them the benefits of wearing our gear as a driver of confidence and, again, the ability to remove those distractions. And if you're playing against a really physical defender, how do you stop from being worried about what the contact may feel like, and how do you just focus on how you get through to them or, you know, get by them without having to worry about getting hurt?
You mentioned a couple of pretty big names here. In addition to Casillas, what are some of the other players?
So at the moment, we work with Jesse Lingard of Manchester United, who's just been a spectacular story. We started working with him when he was really coming up, and then he had a breakthrough year in the World Cup, and now he's a full-out star. We work with Cesar Azpilicueta, Chelsea. We work with Stefan Fry, the Seattle Sounders. We work with Iker, and we're now looking to work more officially with a couple of other names that unfortunately I can't mention, but one of them is a U.S. men national team player. One is a U.S. women's national team player. Both names we're very excited by. And then another one is an English Premier League top goalkeeper.
Once you started getting those, the big names, did you see a big difference in sales?
Again, not the way that you would imagine. The benefit has been one of credibility. People realize that those players are using the gear because they like it and not because we're paying them. Because frankly, imagine trying to compete with Nike, to draw a Nike athletes to wear your gear. I mean, the amount of money they're asking for is just ridiculous. So we wouldn't be able to do that. So players and, you know, customers hopefully can see through our no BS attitude and saying things how they are, and they believe in the concept because they see these players wear it. Whether then you're going to make the leap and try the gear is a different story. So when Jesse Lingard started wearing our gear, it's not like all of a sudden all the Manchester United fans started buying Storelli gear. But some of them who are maybe feel the need, see that and say, okay, like if he's wearing it, then maybe there's something to it. Let me try it out. And what we see is that when people try one of our products, they tend to come back and purchase many others because they work well, they're comfortable, and people see value in it.
If you could spend, let's say, only 2 hours a week on your business, what would you do?
I would make sure that the people within it are trained to look at the key things that really matter for the business in the right way. Because ultimately, delegation is essential. And I think that when I think back at also my daily routine, there's a lot of time that gets spent in checking emails and doing things where you may feel better because you feel like you're doing things, but you're not really progressing. So if I only had 2 hours, I would strive to have 3 key priorities set out for myself, and then for the business, really, and then ensuring that the people within the organization know what those priorities are, so there's extreme clarity and have the tools to be able to take care of them.
Do you seem to be, you know, the type of business leader, you read up a lot, you seem to be thinking a lot about how to manage, how to optimize things. What are techniques, or what are things that you look for that you then can apply to your specific role?
And you mean things as in things that I can learn or things in other people?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think because you bring up an interesting point, right? And I think we all run into that a lot. You know, we have so and so many hours during a day. If we actually analyze it, we do spend so much time on responding to other people's needs. We constantly check email. There's so much time that if you analyze it, probably gets wasted. So you, as kind of this innovative business leader, like, what are some of the things you do to optimize your time? And are there any kind of learnings on that note that you can share?
I have 2 thoughts, and I mean, take them with a grain of salt. That's just my perspective as a startup guy at its first major effort. When it comes to my allocation of time, and I've started implementing this much more rigidly lately, is I really try to think of what are the key elements that will drive competitive advantage and sustainability for my company. And when you really, really end up thinking about them, you there's a million things your company does, but there's only a couple of them that distinguish it and that are essential to it continuing to. So I try to identify those priorities, and when I look at what comes through my desk and what comes through the desk of my colleagues, I try to ask myself a very simple question: is this helping towards priority 1, 2, or 3? And if the answer is no, short of that person just being done with their work, which never happens, I say set it aside. It's a distraction. The ability to sift through distractions and just focus on something starts with defining what you need to focus on. And initially, because we were so starved for growth, it was very easy for us to basically go after every single opportunity. And then with, in some sense, experience, I started getting a sense for what things are game changers and what things really matter and what don't. And then keep the list in front of you and ask yourself, is this helping? And if it's not, it doesn't. That's with business stuff. But then throughout your day, you get all kinds of emails from people asking you, hey, can you talk to me about this, or what about this, or what about that? And very selfishly, just from my professional perspective, I ask myself 2 questions. One of them is this a person that I really care about, and do they really need me? If the answer is yes to both, then dedicate the time. If it's your uncle, cousin, best friend, somebody you care about, somebody who you want to see succeed, and they're asking you to have coffee with them for an hour to help them think through something, then do it. Karma will pay back. Even if it's just the satisfaction of seeing that person succeed, do it. But if it's a remote acquaintance that you're not really invested in or don't particularly care about, or it's a topic that is just not even that important or necessary to them, then you got to be able to look at your time and say, look, I'm sorry, I cannot do it. And I think there's something powerful in recognizing that you need to protect your time and you need to be comfortable with saying no to some people at some times. That's one. And then the other thing that I ask myself is, a lot of times opportunities come about and I look at them and I say, will exposure to this person or this company enrich me in one way or another? Example, maybe you're being approached by a company in a completely different field and it's a field that interests you, and maybe it's a business leader that you admire. There's nothing for you in that meeting directly. Your business will not benefit. There's no business deal to come out of it. But you're going to learn about a different way of doing things. You're going to meet a new person that you find interesting. That's enriching to you as a business leader and as a person. So in that case, then I look at that and I say, okay, yes, this is expanding my network in a valuable way, or expanding me as a person or and a business person. So I take the meeting. But say, you need to be able to say no.
Hey, just a quick update. Coffin Football is now presented by 11 New York, a football brand of high-quality apparel that includes cotton tees, French terry bottoms, and my favorite, socks made out of merino wool. All products are made in Los Angeles and in North Carolina. Please visit 11newyork.com to view it all. And it's a special for Coffin Football listeners. For a 15% off your next purchase, use discount code CF11. That is CF and the number 11. Thanks, guys.
All right, so we're getting towards the end here. I typically shoot a set of rapid-fire questions. If there's anything you want to elaborate on, feel free to do so. But they're typically fairly brief. So what's your favorite team?
AC Milan.
Where does that come from?
My dad happened to be an AC Milan fan, and I grew up in the 80s in Italy when Milan had Marco Van Basten and Ruud Gullit and George Weah, and I just fell in love with the team and follow every game.
If you can't say Messi or Ronaldo, who's the best player in the world?
I'll tell you, we talked about it briefly earlier. At the moment, the player I'm obsessed with is Piątek, the new forward for AC Milan. Because the team has been struggling for a while, and I've been waiting for someone to come about that could give joy back to the game. And I just now watch the games just to see him, because I just find him to be like a really inspiring player.
All right, you heard it here for the first time. Claudio Storelli, he appoints Piątek as the best player in the world after Messi and Ronaldo. Hey, we all have our perspectives and opinions. Let's not talk about that credibility and soccer knowledge, but we'll take that. What's the biggest moment of your career?
Maybe it was just the time. Maybe it was that the lunch meeting back in 2009 where I decided I'm going to do this.
What are you uniquely qualified to do?
Probably very little. But I think that the common theme that I find driving me, and then maybe one day will take me into completely different fields, is getting teams of people excited about making a change and effective at driving that change.
What's a recommendation for someone who wants to follow in your footsteps?
To commit to facing difficulties and with a smile, and to be conscious of the fact that planning is indispensable. You have to do it. But the plans are, in most cases, completely useless, and the things will change completely. And you're going to need to deviate course and need to be flexible, because when you start something, it's very unlikely that things will play out exactly the way that you imagined.
This is very similar, but what's a recommendation for somebody with a startup idea?
I would say the first thing is to make sure that you're passionate about the topic and about what you are embarking on, because you're going to be spending a lot of time thinking about it, and you need to be committed for what's coming. Because otherwise, if you go into it and as soon as you hit some hurdles, you're going to be discouraged. If you're that type of personality, you better get yourself psyched, because there are more hurdles ahead of you than you probably imagine.
Who's a business leader you look up to that you think people should follow?
So this may be a bit strange, but over the years I've had the fortune of interacting with Mike Bloomberg a few times. And what very few people realize is that Mike Bloomberg is actually the sixth richest person in the U.S. after, you know, Zuckerberg and, you know, Bezos and a few others. But he gives all of the profits of the company to charity. And the company is wildly profitable. So after being incredibly successful, Mike embraced the objective to, many ways, make the world a better place. And one of the biggest areas that he invests in is the environment. And I find that even though Mike continues to be very driven and very, very pragmatic, he's not a person, he's not a Mother Teresa person. Like, when you meet the guy, he's no BS and he will do what's in his interest. Ultimately, the output of his success goes to, I think, create a better future. For example, my son, when I think of, you know, what's happening in the environment. And I find that to be inspiring, because if I were to be economically successful, even though probably not to that scale, I will probably take my unique skill in getting people organized towards a goal and start focusing on things that I find have a bit of a greater calling, I guess.
Who's the most well-known soccer contact in your phone?
I'm kind of embarrassed to say, but I don't actually personally interact with a lot of players. Not sure I have any. I mean, one of the people that I'm closest to, it's kind of a funny, is the second goalkeeper on Inter Milan. It's like one of the guys that I just really like as a person, and we just talk about life, and he's just a really good dude. In general, I just don't really. My work puts me in touch with players, but it's rare that I am able to establish a real personal relationship, and I don't seek it because I just don't care for the limelight. So in this case, I connected with him on a personal level, and I really admire him as a person. So it's probably the only one that I stay in touch with.
What's the book that has impacted you the most?
There's been many. One of the ones that I read recently that ties to this, a lot of the stories and the principles that I've discussed, it's it's called The Messy Middle. And it talks about what it's like to go from the moment you start a company to selling it, but really focuses on everything that goes in between. And it draws from a lot of hard-learned lessons. And I found that book to be inspiring and very practical. So from a business perspective, I will say that. From a more life perspective, I love existentialist philosophers, and a lot of some of the themes that I discussed about the way that I try to live my life come from philosophers such as Nietzsche or Camus, or people that are kind of in the existentialist camp. So probably in the way that I've shaped up to be, I will say those have been the ones that have more fundamentally influenced my perspective.
Give me a film recommendation.
I watch a lot of films, so I'm trying to think of what is particularly meaningful. I can't really think of anything particularly inspiring.
What's the most recent one?
One of the most recent ones that I that I also really like astrophysics, and it actually ends up tying to a lot of philosophical elements. So even though it's the big Hollywood production, I really like Interstellar. I'm very, very fascinated with the thought about space exploration. I think it brings about a lot of questions about who we are. It really puts things into perspective, I think, and goes to the bottom of a lot of questions around philosophy and religion. And so even though obviously there's a lot of Hollywood in it, I found something really humbling in the experience and the way the movie is shot of traveling through space. And so that's a movie that I really, really enjoyed on just a deeper level.
You get to have dinner with three people in a soccer world. Let's assume language is not a barrier. Who are the three?
So I have to go revert back to AC Milan, just because that's kind of my frame of reference. At the moment, I'd probably include Donnarumma, just because as a goalkeeper, he's up and coming and he's gone through a lot being so young. I'd love to see if there's more than what you see in the press. I definitely throw Gattuso in there, just because it's Gattuso, and even though he's probably not the most educated of the player, there's something I think highly inspiring about him and his approach to life. And then I'll probably throw an old glory. Paolo Maldini grew up not far from me. Actually, I remember running into him on the streets as a young boy with my babysitter. So maybe I throw Paolo in there. He's a good legend, and I think Paolo, Gattuso, and Donnarumma would be kind of an interesting dinner.
And where would you take them if you had to take them to a New York City restaurant?
New York City restaurant? I go to a place like Hearth. It's on, I think, East 12th and First Avenue. It's a kind of Tuscan Italian place, really, really good, really good food, but also laid back setting. And what I love about it is that they have, at least they used to have, a little box where you could hide your cell phones. And so I'm old school, so I like when we're having dinner not to be bothered by cell phones. So you can hide your phone and like truly focus on the conversation, as opposed to keep worrying about, you know, who's texting.
How can people follow you?
I am admittedly not very active in social media. It's something that I've thought about changing, not so much because I care about the attention, but because I have a lot to say, and I keep thinking about how I can capture some of this knowledge and maybe make it. So maybe there'll be different venues. At the moment, I'm trying to be more proactive in writing content through our blog. So a lot of the articles that we write are actually generally authored by me with the assistance of the team. But eventually I'd love to be able to write more about business and life and the philosophy behind what we do.
What's the Storelli handle for social?
It's storelli.com.
And for Instagram and Twitter?
It's Storelli Soccer on Instagram. That's our main channel. And I think it's Storelli Soccer on Facebook as well.
Last one. Who do you think I should interview on this podcast?
Should go maybe with the third best player in the world. Piotek.
You know what? I'm going to task you to get him for me.
Okay, let's do it.
I might even have you sit in on it.
Yeah, that'd be great.
And watch the third best player in the world being interviewed.
It'd be very disappointing if it turns out he's a totally bland person without personality, you know?
Well, hey, it doesn't matter. He's the third best player in the world, so. All right, Claudio. First and foremost, thank you so much. I've been chasing you, trying to get you on the podcast for a good part of probably over a year or so. Been one of the toughest to get hold of, but you're a busy man. Appreciate the time, and best of luck, man. It's a really inspiring story, and there's tons of learnings here for anybody, whether it's for, you know, in their personal career or somebody who's looking to start a business. So we very much look forward to seeing you progress with this and seeing Storelli succeed. So thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I love the podcast and everything you do, so I appreciate it.
Thank you. Listening, I hope you enjoyed it. If you did,
please subscribe on iTunes and write a review. I would really appreciate it as we grow this podcast one listener at a time. If you have any feedback or ideas, feel free to send me an email at sebastian@coffeeandfootball.com. Stay tuned for next episode. It will be another amazing one. Thanks again, and have a great week.